Good afternoon and welcome to Adelaide Writers Week. I'm Jo Case, Deputy Books and Ideas Editor of The Conversation and a monthly books columnist at In Review. I'd like to start by acknowledging that we are meeting on the traditional country of the Kaurna people of the Adelaide Plains and to pay respect to elders past and present. We recognise and respect their cultural heritage, beliefs and continuing relationship with the land. And we acknowledge that they are of continuing importance to the Kaurna people living today. I'm here with Catherine Lumby, who is a producer at...
Thank you.
I'll let that applause happen. Who is a professor of media at the University of Sydney, where she was founding chair of the Media and Communications Department. Before Catherine entered academia, she worked for two decades as a print and TV journalist for the Sydney Morning Herald, the ABC, and the Bulletin magazine. She has written and co-authored 10 books, including Bad Girls and Gotcha, and has numerous book chapters and journal articles. Frank Morehouse, A Life, is, in Catherine's words, an attempt to connect the life and work of an important Australian writer and to show how the two were inextricably linked. Frank was perhaps best known for his extraordinary Edith trilogy, set in the League of Nations, an ultimately doomed precursor to the United Nations, and in its final volume, In the Early Days of Canberra. Frank asked Catherine to be his biographer a decade before his death. She got him and his work, he said, in a way few others did. Indeed, the form of this biography, which moves forward through time in themed loops and feels more like a biography of ideas and changing times through Frank's life and his work than a traditional go-to-woe biography, feels really fitting, I thought, for a writer whose work was so intricately tied to his life and times. Catherine traces Frank's involvement in crusades against censorship and for creative copyright payments, and his support for gay liberation, feminism, and Aboriginal rights. It shows how he was shaped by his times and how he shaped them in return. And it puts the specificities of his character and obsessions, including his complicated sexuality and his love of both formal rituals and unconventional ways of living, centre stage. And of course, the book is a thorough engagement with Frank's work, from his debut collection, Futility and Other Animals, in 1966, to the last volume of the Edith trilogy, Cold Light, his book about ASIO, and his unpublished erotic novella. And it's all explored thematically rather than in linear order. As a fan of Frank's work, I really loved this book and I'm delighted to be talking to Catherine about it with all of you today. Please welcome Catherine.
Thanks, Jo. I'm delighted to be in conversation with you. I'm a big fan of your work, so there.
Well, this has made my day. Catherine, I'd like to start by asking you how you came to write Frank's biography and what it was that attracted you to the project. You write about your first affection for Frank's fiction as a working class Newcastle teenager, and that it gave you a glimpse of a bohemian cosmopolitan world out there. What did his work mean to you and how did you come to write it?
So I grew up in Newcastle. I'm 62 years old, so I was a teenager in the 70s. And I was sitting on the hockey field, as we all were in those days, with baby oil on my legs, sunning them, actually probably getting skin cancer. And I was a sort of skinny, nerdy brunette who wrote bad derivative poetry, which didn't endear me to the surfy boys. It was a working class surfing culture. And I have great affection for Newcastle, but I didn't really fit in. And my parents, who... I come from a largely working-class background, but they were avid readers, and I sort of monkey-climbed their bookcase to find some volumes at the top of great interest to me at the age of 13. One of them was The Joy of Sex. All that hair, my God. And The other one was a collection of short fiction called Beautiful Lies, which was some of the earliest published work of some of our most now famous authors like Peter Carey, Murray Bell, Frank Morehouse among them. And it was a glimpse of a bohemian world and a political and cultural and social milieu that I wanted to be part of. And I mean, the other influence for me was I remember seeing on television, black and white TV in Newcastle in those days, and seeing Germaine Greer on television and thinking, oh my God, there's the exit sign. So, and I told Frank all of that when I met him in the 90s, the mid-90s. I was living in New York, writing my first book, and we met at, we were on a panel together at the improbably titled Festival of Australian Ideas in Washington. And I'm, when I met up with him, I said, are you going to talk about the Hills Hoist and I'll talk about the Esky, or how are we going to divide this topic up, right? And then I told him how much I loved his work. And so I think the fact that he said I got him is probably a sign that he knew I was a deep fan.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had been, you know, since I was a teenage girl.
Mm. Well, didn't you also write a profile? I think you're being a little bit too modest. Didn't you also write a profile of him, which he loved, and it was also through that that he felt like you really got him?
Yeah, I wrote a profile for The Bulletin. When I was at The Bulletin magazine as a columnist and a feature writer, I wrote a profile of him, and he said, yes, I think you really understand the nuances of my work. And I think his work is extremely nuanced. And I'm sure that there are... hands up if you're a fan of Frank Morehouse's writing. Yes!
Oh, excellent.
That's great to know.
Yeah. We're in good company.
You know, and I think when... I guess I'll just say this briefly. Mm. One of the things that I think Frank meant when he said I got him was that... and this is what I've tried to do in the biography, was that I felt... that I had an argument to prosecute about the connection between the diverse genres he worked across. So he worked in comic essays, he worked in short stories, the discontinuous narrative, and then the large novels, as well as the journalism and the activism. And I felt that I could see what the through line was in these things.
Oh, that's so interesting, because that is what you've done with your biography. Yeah, is connect, is make, it's very much a work of making connections. And one of the things I loved about reading it as a Frank fan, but just, you know, so a fan of reading about ideas, was that I feel like you really invite us into that process of making connections with you. And if you're a Frank fan, you can also kind of have your own connections you're making as you go. So, yeah. I mean, for instance, there are observations you make about Frank that made me think, God, you know, I was thinking about the similarities to Helen Garner, and a couple of pages later you have this comparison of Frank and Helen Garner, and I just felt like we were chatting like this. Maybe you can tell everyone here, what are those similarities that you saw between Frank and Helen?
Well, Helen Garner is, you know, one of the greatest living writers ever, and just an astounding writer, and I mean, I continue to read and reread her books. And I think that what they both have, and in fact there was a New Yorker essay on Helen Garner's work called titled Helen Garner's Savage Self-Scrutiny. And Frank brought, as Helen has, brought with thin disguise people in his milieu into his work. Fun fact, this is weird. I got married for the first time in my life 3 years ago to a man who's actually a character in Monkey Grip.
No.
He lived in the Monkey Grip household. I think that's why I married him. But so, and I've, because through my husband, because he knows Helen well, I've had the opportunity to ask her about this, because she and Frank both did this. They brought within disguise people around them in their cultural and political milieu, and they had to ponder the ethics of doing that.
Yeah.
And but what they also share is they weren't just turning their gaze, and in Frank's case, often an ironic gaze, onto people and the milieu around them. They were turning it back on themselves primarily.
And they both, like you say, they were both in this kind of libertarian, world of the 60s, writing about the tension between politics, politics as ideas and politics as, lived in houses and in relationships. And you say that Frank is, one of the most, among Australian male writers, one of the ones who can write about women the best and most perceptively. So was that...
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is what one of the things that I find deeply interesting about Frank, and we can talk a bit about the sexuality element and why that, I think, is relevant.
Mm.
But he always wrote with, I think, genuine empathy about women. He was observing, as people were in the 70s, observant and ethical people were, the grand experiments that were occurring. Not in the hockey fields of Newcastle High, I can tell you, but but in Carlton and Fitzroy, in Balmain in Sydney, and in other, bohemian areas of cities around Australia. And, and people were engaging in open relationships. They were experimenting with that. But, of course, one of the harsh realities of that is women in the 70s, even after the pill became available and it wasn't a particularly pleasant drug to be taking in those days, were often left literally holding the baby or managing the aftermath of the abortion. So there was sexual liberation was a very dominant narrative at the time, but women's liberation was a rumble or a distant storm on the horizon that gathered strength as that decade progressed. But I have to say this, because Frank always had a way of making me laugh about complex issues. I remember having lunch with him once and I said to him, Frank, after the 70s and all the open relationships and everything, do you think monogamy can work? And he said, no. And then he summoned a waiter and he got napkins and a pen brought over, and we spent the rest of the lunch designing the monogamy house. Now, apparently to make monogamy work, you need a 30-storey house, which includes separate his and hers flossing rooms. I haven't tried it, but...
Fantastic. And I love that story too, because it really shows how Frank would... his joy in then diving into, well, how would that work? What would the rules be? Like, yes. Rules for living.
Yes.
Yeah. Can you talk a bit about Frank's that affinity he had for finding rules for living in, for everything, and also how that existed alongside him living a very unconventional life?
Yeah, see, this is a fascinating thing, and part of understanding this, and it's in the first chapter of my biography, and certainly Matthew Lamb explores this in his excellent first volume of his biography on Frank that came out in December. So I encourage all Frank fans to buy that book too. He grew up in a very middle-class, upstanding household in Nowra. There's a Morehouse Park, which is a memorial to his parents. His father was ran a company with the wonderful name Morehouse the Machinery Man. And his other sons followed him into the family business. He, in fact, invented the first dairy boiler, so the first machine for sterilising milk.
Yeah, wow.
And Frank's mother, Perth, was, the head of the CWA. She was on every committee. She was obsessed with committees and taking minutes and rules. And so I think Frank inherited a lot of that from her, and in fact, this is given full flight in the character of Edith Campbell Berry,
yes,
the League of Nations, and the League of Nations being that most spectacular experiment and tragically failed experiment to make civilised rules of living for the whole world.
Yeah, yeah.
How fabulous would that be? We need a bit of that at the moment.
Well, yes. I think you said that was part of what drew Frank to writing about the League of Nations was that idea. Can you maybe tell us a bit about what the League of Nations was trying to do and how it fell apart, and how Frank chronicles that in Grand Days and Dark Palace?
Yeah, so for those of you who haven't read it, Grand Days is about the rise of the League of Nations, which was, you know, a body that predates the UN that was put together after the tragedy of the Great War, the First World War, and all the horrific loss of life, to try to prevent war, essentially, if I boil it down, but also to do a whole range of other things that might seem bizarre to us now, like standardise the calendar. Well, that didn't work because the Pope objected because of Easter and the Chinese objected for other reasons and, you know, no. So there were a lot of... This was an attempt to standardise global rules for living. And Frank spent 5 years in the archives at the League of Nations. I don't know if anyone's been to the archives of the League of Nations. Hands up, anyone been there in Geneva? If you go to Geneva, go. It's really fascinating because there's a kind of museum to the League of Nations there. And so... Grand Days is about the rise. Dark Palace is about the tragic fall in the wake of the rise of National Socialism in Germany. And but when Frank was researching it, he got obsessed with how did they make these rules? And more importantly, and this is very much like his mother, what kind of furniture was in the room? Right. Frank was a great believer, and he would do this if you went to lunch with him. Who sat where? What time to begin festivities, most importantly, when to end them. You know, what kind of drink you should have with what. He believed that these sort of rituals and rules kept things... he liked a bit of chaos, but he wanted to contain it. So I always described him as our man at the edge of the cultural cliff, staring with some alarmed fascination at the rocks that lie below.
That's a great description, yeah. And yes, like, I mean, Edith Campbell-Berry does... There's a lot of that in the Edith trilogy, isn't it, of those minute kind of considerations about furniture or, you know, protocols. But, I mean, in Cold Light, which is about the early days of Canberra, Edith, you know, she's a great admirer of the Burley Griffins, isn't she?
She loved the Burley... Frank, of course, loved the Burley Griffins, and particularly Marion, who was an architect, and she, of course, didn't get the spotlight that Walter did. But... and what Frank loved... So Cold Light is set in Canberra, and again, Canberra is a highly designed city, and Frank became fascinated by the history of Canberra and how it's a city that is designed to represent democracy to us, and that it the way it is laid out is a reminder when you go to Canberra about a certain kind of order and a sense of civility, of civics, a lesson in civics, if you like. So Edith Campbell-Berry, who leaves the League of Nations after its fall, goes to Canberra with her lover Ambrose and becomes obsessed with things like sanitation and garbage collection, you know, and how these could be reflective of national values and being Australian.
Yeah.
Hilarious, really.
And, I mean, it really is. Frank always manages to make those details fascinating, I guess maybe because he was fascinated by them, but because he always shows what they represent, you know, tells a story through them. I mean, it might sound like, oh, you know, reading about furniture or sanitation is not that interesting, but it is. Frank has also said that he drew on both of his parents in his work with his very slim 1974 novel, The Electrical Experience, about an inventor representing his father, and then the Edith trilogy, three very fat novels, represented his mother, and he joked that that was proportional to their influence on him.
Well, I think his therapist told him that.
Oh, there you go. But do you think that's true? Because there's also a lot of... a lot of Frank in Edith, isn't there? And there's also Frank, as you also can see him in Ambrose. So, yeah.
Well, this might bring us to the question of Frank's personal life, which he became very open about eventually, but, you know, because of the criminal law in the 1960s and into the 70s. I mean, I've got to say, last year I was teaching a course at Sydney Uni on media law and ethics and talking to 20, 23-year-old students... And I managed to get a collective gasp from 120 of them when I explained that homosexuality had only been decriminalised in New South Wales in 1985. Like, that was unimaginable, thank God, to this group of people.
Yeah.
So Frank was writing about gay sex in his earliest work. He was a bisexual man. He was also a cross-dresser.
Yeah.
Now, Ambrose is... I mean, that's the term Frank uses. So I'm treading carefully here because, you know, there are different ways of describing that practice now. But he described himself as, to me once, as bi-gendered and a cross-dresser is how he described it, that practice. That was something he did at home. I mean, he would be, as he put it, on fam in the evenings. That was how he relaxed.
Mm.
And so he tapped into a deeply feminine side. And I without, you know, trying to be an amateur psychoanalyst, I do think that he had a deep relationship to the feminine, and that that is probably part of how he was able to create a character as fully realised as Edith. Mind you, I have this joke with a number of Frank's female friends. We would occasionally get an email from Frank asking us details about lingerie so he could get it right.
Oh, really?
Which I thought was gorgeous.
Oh, that's fantastic. He did his research.
He did his homework, yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was so interesting reading the section in your book where you do write about Frank's journey in terms of his sexuality, that it's like he wrote about it in his fiction long before he talked about it, even though, because, you know, homosexuality was illegal. And you quote him saying, "I think when I was writing fiction, I had numbed myself to the risks I was taking." And I wonder, what do you think it was that made him explore his sexuality in his work before he felt, and also like exploring what he called his cross-dressing in his work, long before he felt ready to talk about either of those things publicly?
Because his commitment to being a writer was so deep.
Yeah.
I mean, I went back into the... Well, I spent a lot of time in the archives, which are held at the Fryer Library. This is Frank Moorhouse's archives. His archivist is the wonderful Nicholas Pounder. Some of you may know of Nicholas. He had a bookstore in Sydney for many decades, and he's an archivist. So the juvenilia in the archive, you know, you can see from his early teens, Frank is writing about his mission to be a writer and the duty of being a writer. He took that very seriously. And he felt a bit like Helen Garner, I think, is a very good comparison here, that there was a rigorous and ruthless honesty and self-scrutiny that was required in that work.
Yeah, and with both of them, I feel like when I'm right, when you read about them and then read their work, and sometimes also then when you read the reaction, you know, the ripples effect that the work has on real life, it feels like they have a compulsion to tell the truth and mind the self in the writing that overrides any concerns about effect. And... Yeah, Frank, for instance, in his memoir of sorts, Martini, I think that's an interesting example. He blurred. Martini is the closest he got to, well, saying he'd written a memoir.
Yes, that's right. It was sort of semi-fictionalised memoir.
Yeah. I almost felt, when I reread it, and felt like he was teasing me with it, you know, like, because
who's
it's...
this?
Yeah, and there's so much of... It's much more about the cultural history of the martini than, about himself. So it's like he's daring you, like, okay, if you want to know this, you're going to also read about this and you enjoy the journey. But in that, he also really blurs the boundaries, as you say, between fiction and memoir, which ended up getting him into some trouble with his ex-wife. Can you tell us about that?
So this is the one... So Frank, when he was... in his last year, 2 years of high school, he met a young woman called Wendy Halloway, who was very bright and is now a journalist editor who lives in London, and I've interviewed her and been in contact with her. And they got married very young, and she went off to Sydney to do nursing, which was the kind of career path for a young woman like her, even though she herself wanted to be a writer. And they married very young. But at this stage, Frank had already begun his first very serious homosexual relationship, which actually lasted most of his life, along with many other relationships. I mean, it's hard to... You've got to go into the Frank Morehouse archives to understand the extent of Frank's amorous adventures, because they are many and fascinating. And I think Wendy and he understandably divorced, like many young couples did in those days. But they remained good friends. And then in Martini, he kept a copy of every significant letter he ever sent, and he kept every significant letter he ever received. So, you know, hats off to Matthew Lamb, who's got much more of an appetite for detail than I do. You know, and good for him, because Matthew's really gone through with a tooth comb. But she wrote him love letters as a teenage girl and as a nurse, and he kept them and he cited them, quoted them in Martini. And that was the first time she told me that she ever felt betrayed by Frank, because she felt that he'd really intruded into her personal space. And that brings up this interesting question of those boundaries. So when I was... Yeah. Are you happy for me to talk about being in the archives? Okay. Yes. So the afterword of the book, for people who are interested if they read the book, is about the ethics of biography and how writing this biography really challenged me ethically. The best example I can give of this is one day I was in the archives and Nicholas Pounder, the archivist, had accompanied me, and he put a folder this thick in front of me on my desk, and he said, "I think you'll find this of some interest." That's how Nicholas talks, a little archly, he said. And I said, OK, and I opened it and I started reading these letters from a 17-year-old Perth schoolgirl to Frank. And then as I read them, I realised it was, and I can say it because she's agreed this is fine, it was one of my closest friends, Fiona Giles, who is now an accomplished author and academic. And she met him when she was 17 and he was 38, and they commenced a love affair, which resulted in him eventually writing a book called 4017, which is about their relationship. And this was a relationship, a very passionate sexual and intellectual relationship that lasted for 13 years. And the last letter in the file is an unsent suicide letter to Fiona from Frank when she broke it off, finally. So I'm reading this, and this is one of my closest friends, and they're both writers, so the letters are by turns literary, pornographic, emotional, and I found myself in the sandstone quadrangle of the University of Queensland where the archives are, and I called Fiona crying and sobbing, and I said, "I don't feel I should be reading this. This is a trespass." And she said, "Oh, darling, you're the biographer. You have to read everything. Better you than some horny old Marxist."
Oh, that's fabulous. I thought you were going to take us to that story with going into the archives. Thank you. And then actually, I did want to touch on 4017 and the book that Frank wrote about that relationship, because, I mean, it also occurred to me, it's, you know, if that was published now, it would be very shocking to publish about a relationship, you know, that age gap. But it was a different time, it was a long relationship, and the fact that she remained a dear friend throughout his life, you're like... And it raises the question, which you also explore at one point in the book of, you know, is it ever appropriate to critique a work of literature on the basis that it somehow fails an ideological test, particularly of a different time, like to apply our values to something that... So, yeah, I just wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah, well, this is something that I write about at some length in the book and I struggled with. And I'm actually surprised no reviewer picked up on it, because I thought if anyone's going to pick up on anything in this book, it'll be exactly what you've just asked me about. So Frank... in a number of his fictional works, has written about intergenerational sex, if I can... That's a very neutral term for it. Mm. We live in a time, thankfully, where we are far more aware of power abuses and of the horrific extent of child sexual abuse, both within the family and in institutions. The libertarian... So if we go back to the push, the Sydney push, which... in Melbourne, it was the Melbourne Drift. There were these... There was a writer, a psychoanalyst and philosopher, Wilhelm Reich, whose theory, some of you will know, was that if we can release all our sexual repression, we'll end capitalism. That's putting it in a nutshell. Okay. I don't know about that. But so this is an era before women's liberation, before a lot of awareness of the power inequities that structure social relations. It's a very male-dominated era, really. Yeah. And there was quite a strong kind of element in that that, you know, it was absolutely fine to have children inducted into sex. Now, I'm not saying everyone was doing that, but it was certainly discussed and theorised about. And I'm not for a second...
When you say that, do you mean children as in teenagers?
Well, or... I mean, even children. Mm, I mean, okay. On the sort of more extreme fringes of Reichian sexual politics.
Right.
But certainly with the idea of what is a child, who is a child. I mean, I would say this. As a 14-year-old in Newcastle, we used to hang outside the stage door of the Civic Theatre in our denim, fully denimed wear, and roadies would come out the back door and... point at girls with blonde hair and go, come backstage for the sound check.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, I and everyone here is rightly horrified by that.
Mm.
But it was a period, I think what we've done is we've extended what we understand to be childhood. And Fiona and I have talked about her being 17 and she says that she recognises retrospectively the huge power imbalance and that while... She wrote a wonderful piece in the Monthly celebrating Frank and his work and their relationship that she also thinks she was way too young to enter into that relationship with an older writer. So yeah, I think we're living at a time when, quite rightly, our mores and our understanding of power relationships have changed.
Mm. And do you think there's a difference between perhaps criticising or reassessing these things, like as... You know, Fiona obviously was reassessing in her piece and condemning it when it was something in a different age. And I don't mean this as a blanket thing, but, you know, there's, as you and I have talked about, the idea of that things are, you know, black and white is a difficult thing, you know.
Well, I'm not in favour of revisionism.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a strong believer that the work stands and... We can also say it's of its time and, you know, the values or the sort of aesthetics or whatever, the ethos that's expressed is something that we know more about now.
Yes,
I mean, for one thing,
right.
Child sexual abuse was not on the radar. It wasn't that it wasn't happening. Mm. It just wasn't... There wasn't a public consciousness about the extent of it.
Yeah, that's right. And, I mean, I get... You did say, you know, Frank had a great, you know, he liked to push taboos, but that he identified sex with prepubescence as a line.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And I'm not suggesting encourage that in any way. But, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, he was... the fingerprints of libertarianism remain on his work in the same way they do on Germaine Greer's earlier work. In the female eunuch.
Yeah.
She was very much of the push at that point.
I wonder... I'd like to ask you about... I'm just going to push this one further here.
Okay.
Which is you write about Frank's unpublished erotic novella, Sunny, which was about a post-pubescent high school student who arrives at boarding school... Having been inducted into sex by his mother and on arriving, gets a lesson in anal sex from a head counsellor. And both scenarios, as you say, breach major taboos and ethics. And you say particularly, you know, now we see that with the now that we know so much about the sexual abuse of children in families and institutions that have come to life. Was it difficult to write about, you know, did you consider whether or not to include that unpublished novella in the book, and was that hard? Like, did you see that novella as pushing things a bit too far?
Yeah, but I thought it had to be there. Yeah. I mean, I read the work. It was never published. I would submit it's unpublishable. Mm. Frank, when I talked to him about it, said that, and in fact there's a letter he wrote to his publisher, Whitwell, about why he'd written it. He described it to me once. He wrote it when he was writing Dark Palace, you know, which he described as trying to, this is about the League of Nations, trying to raise the Titanic. And he said he did it to entertain himself, and he said Sonny was like, you know, playing jazz and dancing on a nightclub bar. And he would, if he was here, I'm pretty sure he would still say this, that the work of the erotic imagination is just that, that there is, I mean, he would probably argue that, you know, if you look at, say, people's sexual fantasies, they're very different to what people would often do in practice. That is the sort of argument that he would make about it. And I've got to say, I'm sympathetic to what he's saying, but I'm also very conscious that works of fiction or any work of art lands in a particular climate, and it, right at the moment, that climate is quite rightly a very charged climate when it comes to the protection of children and young teenagers.
Yep. No, thank you for that. I thought it was a good one to touch on, but a tricky one. You write that Grand Day's the first Edith book focuses explicitly and implicitly on borders, on the crossing of borders and the meaning of borders, national and other, and identity. And I wonder if you can speak to that and how it speaks to the personal and political aspects of that novel.
Yeah, so, I mean, Edith Campbell-Berry is a young woman from Jasper's Brush, so she, in a way, is a bit of a cipher for Frank. You know, a young man from the South Coast. She embarks on this grand adventure to go to Geneva, and where she's a secretary and rises through the ranks of the secretariat at the League of Nations. So one of the border crossings is about what does it mean to be Australian on a global stage. He was very interested in this concept of the cultural cringe, you know, the performance of national identity, the performance of self, And I guess implicitly the role of the nation state in relation to the global. And he was conscious in writing about the League of Nations that one of the things the League of Nations was trying to do was to de-ossify ideas of nationality and the nation state. Because, of course, the nation state, we could argue, is somewhat of a fiction. Those borders are movable. Those boundaries are permeable. And it's very much an invention, really, of the 19th century in many ways. So he was interested from that perspective. I mean, he once said to me that we were talking about speaking another language, and he said, I think everyone becomes a different person in a different language.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I speak French and German a bit, and I sort of thought, yeah, it's true, right? There's some truth to that. So he was interested in the performance of self and the relationship between national identity and self, but he was equally interested in the crossing of other sorts of borders. So Ambrose, who is Edith's mentor and then lover, is a cross-dresser, and, you know, he goes around, he's British, very British, and he goes around in kind of Savile Row suits during the day and mainly wears regimental pyjamas to bed, but occasionally hops into a frock.
Yes.
Right.
Silk nightgown, yes.
So he was, I think, I mean, you know, these days we talk a lot about being non-binary or, as one of my kids would, you know, attest, non-binary and pansexual and all of those things. I think, which is all great. I think Frank was onto that well before this generation.
Yeah.
And was very interested in how we deconstruct, well, that's an academic word, how we dissolve binaries. Mm. Why are we so interested in making things binary when there's always a kind of third way? What's the sort of, how does water flow through rocks, I suppose?
Mm. Mm. I mean, yeah, reading his work, you know, he does often seem to be at the forefront of these things, like we say, you know, writing about homosexuality and then, you know, just, like you say, porous sexuality, hard to define sexuality long before we were all talking about it now. So, yeah.
Yeah, so I think he was very, very conscious that things are always more fluid than meet the eye.
Mm.
And even just in your own personal identity, he was very interested in the performance of persona.
Yeah.
And that goes back to, you know, why he loved, or he hated dinner parties because he could get trapped. And he there's a fantastic comic essay where he talks about the ritual dinner party cursing of an assumed mutual enemy. So everyone is, you know, they go around the table and everyone has to bring bad news of the enemy, you know, presumably a politician or some political cause, right? And he was very interested in the way, you know, in our social lives, in our public lives, we practice and present a certain persona, like you and I are doing now, right?
Absolutely, huh? Yeah.
And then what lies behind that?
Mm.
And I think that also goes to the core of his understanding of identity and white matter and the fact that it's never so fixed, that we are slightly different people with different people.
Mm, yeah, I think that actually that's one of the things that I love most about his work is his deep interest in the performance of the self and us being not just different people in different languages but different people in different rooms. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Before I soon turn it over to questions, you have a little bit you'd like to read to us.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Okay, I chose this bit just because I think it's on point. There's a lot of discussion at the moment about so-called cancel culture and virtue signalling and wokeness. Now, they're all terms that have, in my view, for what it's worth, been weaponised by the right wing. And so I'm not buying into that. I am a very left-wing person. However, there are times where, and I guess this is partly being a professor at Sydney Uni, I'm observing a turn in politics, and God bless their cotton socks for being political, back to a sort of more hard left early 70s form of protest. And I mean, at times it's a bit my way or the highway. You're with me or you're against me. And this is something that I discussed with Frank a lot. He was, because of his libertarian background, always very suspicious of that of moral certitude or what he would term self-righteousness. So I just wanted to read a little bit about his involvement in censorship activism and thank you, Frank, for being part of that. Because the other thing we haven't really touched on is he was an activist for writers, for copyright, you know, a great mentor to many brilliant young writers who are now senior writers. And but at this time he was living with Sandra Levy, who's a wonderful woman, a film and television producer, and a very important person right throughout Frank's life. Morehouse had his own brushes with the law because of his censorship activism. So this is in the early 70s. He recalled that he and his then partner, Sandra Levy, were shopping in Balmain one afternoon when two detectives approached them and said they wanted to search her car. Quote, I said that it was not legal for them to search the car, not knowing at the time whether it was or not, and not having a clue what they wanted to find. They then dragged me from the car and a fight between them and Sandra and I broke out. A police van was called and we were arrested and taken to the Balmain police station. Morehouse didn't say if there were fisticuffs involved, but I, for one, would pay to see two policemen try to face off against the formidable Sandra Levy. As Levy herself recalls it, she had for once actively tried to avoid being arrested for antagonising the authorities because she had a full-time and senior job at the ABC. She remembers that Morehouse was the one who had loaded the cargo into her station wagon. And some in the audience may remember these publications. It turned out that the cops had spied through the car's rear window copies of Thor, an underground magazine, and another publication, The Little Red Schoolbook, which encouraged young people to challenge social norms and included information about sex and drug use. So they were charged, but eventually they countersued and they were fined $5. So his opposition to censorship became a lifelong concern expressed through essays and public commentary. And I'll just read this quote and finish. In a satirical essay, The Urge to Censor, written 30 years after the early censorship battles, he takes considered aim at the rationale underpinning pro-censorship rhetoric. Quote, It was as if we had been in a deep after-lunch sleep and had awoken, not sometime in the future, but back in our more tumultuous past, back in the 70s, no less. It was not an agreeable sensation. We are not up to returning to the 70s. This disagreeable sense of déjà vu was caused by growing evidence of a resurgence of the dreaded urge to censor, the internet panic, the re-establishment of federal and state censorship, all show us that the bitch is back on heat.
Terrific. Thank you, Catherine. If you have a question that you would like to ask Catherine, please make your way to the microphone here. And I'll just ask that you do make it a question and not a statement. And just remember that we are all... Adelaide Writers' Week is in favour of respectful language, which I'm sure you would use. I'm going to keep talking to Catherine unless... but if I see you standing at the mic, I will gesture to you.
No one? I'll give you a Fredo Frog. I mean...
well, I've got plenty more I would like to talk to you about.
Okay, go.
So... I actually, with that reading that you just gave, I did mention to you before that I like that you wrote that Frank had always remained sceptical of ideological positions animated by a sense of self-righteousness or claims to a monopoly on the truth, and that he believed in countering ugly or offensive dialogue with more speech. And it made me wonder how he would have navigated the times we're in right now, where its nuance is difficult.
Yeah, and I guess it's something I have in common with Frank. Frank, I would say, had an ethos of listening, and he got himself into trouble quite often because if he detected sort of moral sanctity or certainty. He had a tendency to ironise it, right? And in fact, it's in the book that, you know, in the 70s he got taken to task for being too ironic. I mean, there's a fabulous story, and I should remember what, I think it's in Futility and Other Animals. Oh, no, it's in The American's Baby, where there's a visiting American poet, and it's set in someone's lounge room in Balmain, and everyone's trying to outdo themselves to be more radical. And, you know, and Frank is kind of observing all of this with a bemused sort of ironic stare. And I can kind of relate to that too. You know, I guess whenever he felt that people collectively had this sense that they had a monopoly on the truth, his urge was to say, well, hang on a minute. And he actually enjoyed being open to having his mind changed, which I think personally is a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And you did say that one thing you liked about both Frank and Helen Garner was that idea that you read their work and you finish it with more questions than answers, perhaps, which is great and speaks to that. We have a question here.
Yay. Hi, thank you very much for your talk. The booker that I'm in has recently read the first two of the Edith trilogy, which we greatly enjoyed. But we were a bit curious because we read that Grandet's missed out on the Miles Franklin?
Great question.
And that Frank was understandably annoyed, missed out because of lack of Australian content, as we understood. Mm. And we just wondered whether that was the rationale for the inclusion of Edith's return briefly to Australia in Dark Palace.
Oh, that's a great question. Thank you. So there was a literary luncheon, actually. So what happened was the Miles Franklin, which is obviously an award for, you know, a great work of Australian fiction with an Australian theme, despite the fact that it involves a young woman from the south coast of New South Wales who goes to the League of Nations, and a lot of it is about her Australian identity in relation to the global, was disqualified as insufficiently Australian. And Frank, of course, was very disappointed by this. And there was a literary luncheon at which he gave a very tongue-in-cheek, ironic, sort of satirical Frank speech about the cultural cringe. And it erupted into a bit of a melee, which, you know, literary luncheons rarely do, unless there's a lot of martinis consumed. And it became quite a cause célèbre, and it prompted this debate about, well, what is it, you know, what is Australian fiction? How do we discern this? Frank said, oh, I imagine the judges of the Miles Franklin, because I was working in Geneva, imagined me lunching on the Riviera, and, you know, he kind of made a joke out of it. But yes, no, it's a great question. I think that actually is something that is segued into Dark Palace, and I think it enriched the book because he makes explicit this question about what is Australian identity, indeed what is national identity, which loops back to the core of the question at the heart of the League of Nations.
Mm. And do you know, I once was speaking to an Australian writers about what makes an Australian writer, and someone, I think it was Sophie Cunningham, mentioned what we've just been talking about and said, but there's, in a way, there's nothing more Australian than writing a character who goes to the other side of the world, Europe, to find themselves.
Well, yes. You know, and, I mean, I remember Robert Hughes, the art critic. Bob said at the time, he weighed into the debate, and he said, you know, how absolutely ridiculous. He said, you know, do we love David Malouf for being of Lebanese origin and dislike him for spending so much time in Italy? Like, pick a lane.
Yeah. Great. Yes, we have another question here.
Yeah, hi, how could I resist the offer of a Freddo frog?
Well, I'll give you a martini because you're the second questioner.
Oh, wow, okay. I'll front up to the stage. Look, my question, I guess, is I should declare that my pronouns are she and they.
Yes.
So I have a non-binary identity or even a bi-gender identity in some ways. And I'm just, thank you for shedding a whole light on a whole lot of complexity in Frank Moorhouse's character and so on, and identities. I wonder how he would have viewed today the somewhat charged debate over the identity, particularly it's focused on transgender women,
yes,
about them being real women. So how would he have viewed that, do you think?
Well, that's a fantastic question. Yeah. Thank you so much. I actually did get the opportunity to talk to Frank a bit about this because my youngest, as I said, identifies as non-binary, and we talked about this 5 years ago or so, and Frank was very pro that, was all for it, and very excited that there was now a range of ways of expressing gender and sexuality, and I think would have been very suspicious of the term real woman. And I am myself, actually, at the risk of getting myself into all kinds of hot water. What is a real woman? What does that mean? That kind of notion of a particular authenticity is something that Frank would question. Frank, in fact, if I can try and channel Frank here, I think he would say, the more the merrier. Welcome to the party.
Wonderful. Thanks. I wanted to circle back and write. You touched on the fact that there are two biographies that were published, well, within months of each other after Frank's death. You touched on Matthew Lamb, who is writing a two-volume biography, and his first volume came out. I thought it was so interesting to... I mean, it's very unusual for that to happen, especially with both biographers having cooperated with the subject. And I actually think they complement each other very nicely because they're doing very different things. Why do you think Frank was working with two biographers? And what's it like to have the two books coexisting?
Well, I mean, so it was different for me because I had a friendship with Frank that, and the friendship then grew into the biographical relationship, which I wouldn't say it didn't ruin our friendship or something, but it tempered the relationship. Mm. You know, naturally it does, you know, because he was, I think, more guarded at times with me than he would have been prior to that. Now, Matthew embarked on it. He got a biographical award. I've forgotten the name of it, I should remember. Anyway, he got, you know, an award, a prize to write the biography. Mm. And he and I were often in the archives at the same time. And when I knew that he was working on this, I went over and said, "Oh, Matthew, hi, I'm Catherine. I'll take you out to dinner tonight. You know, anything I've got, I'm happy to share with you," right?
Great.
Because my view is, like, the more books on Frank, the better. It's about Frank. Mm. And I think we very quickly learnt that we were writing really different books.
Yeah.
Matthew is a person of high detail, right? I don't have a lot of appetite for detail. Maybe I'm lazy, but I was very clear I wanted to write a thematic book, and for Matthew it's very woe to go. I think he starts with Frank's great-grandfather. Mm. And so if you want the detail, I mean, his two volumes will be the classic important works for literary scholars and for people with a deep interest in Frank's life and work. And I can do is applaud Matthew for the immense amount of work and his appetite for detail that he's put into these books.
Thank you. I think that's great that you were able to... Like, it's so unusual, but good that the answer to that is not that it was a contentious thing, but a very collegiate thing. And actually, I've spoken to Matthew when his book came out and he also felt the same way, that there's
room for both. Oh, he's a lovely guy.
Yeah.
And we're just very different cats.
Yeah.
But you know, we got on and he shared things with me and I shared things with him. Yeah.
Yeah. And I would say that it's not that you don't work with detail, because you've pulled out some fantastic detail. It's just, you know, you're selective about the detail. That's what I would... You're using the detail to tell a story rather than the accumulation of detail being the aim, was how I felt.
Well, I mean, you know, I suppose it's... The biography is a genre that creeps up on every biographer, and every biographer slightly recasts the genre. So you write the book that's in you.
Yep. I wonder if I can ask you about Mary McGeechy, who was a Canadian woman who'd worked at the League and was one of the models for Edith. And I love the story about how Frank, you know, she was 90. Frank had been researching her for ages and then was shocked to be able to actually meet her.
Yeah, it's amazing. So he's in the archives, you can imagine. He's been there, you know, it's a five-year period. And he comes across these letters from a woman who's a secretary, a Canadian woman, and he goes, "Oh, my God, this is Edith," right? He'd already had the character of Edith, but this woman then becomes Edith for him. Mm. And through happenstance, some friends in France happen to know her family in New York. And so he gets on a plane and she's in her late 90s, I think, at this stage. And he gets led into a room where she's sitting in a rocking chair, you know, and she's got quite serious memory loss at this point, but she can remember in vivid detail the cobblestone streets in Geneva. Mm. I almost feel like crying saying this. The way he put it to me was so effective. He said he touched her hand and it was like reaching back through the annals of history connecting with this woman who'd been part of such an important, you know, organisation. And she told him, this is gorgeous, he asked her what she'd like to drink, and she mentioned a drink which he knew in the 1920s was really popular. It was a version of a martini. And she said, I'll end on this, she said it was a girl, it was a drink that naughty girls drank, and naughty girls make the best companions.
Fantastic. Thank you, Catherine. That's a great way to end. Look, thank you so much, Catherine, for writing this book and sitting here and talking to us all about it. Catherine will be at the book tent signing copies. Please go up and chat to her. I don't know that she has Freddo frogs, but
well, she will sign your book. Well, if you bring gin and vermouth, I'll show you how to make a martini.
Thank you.
Thank you.